I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk with Lieutenant Governor Sue Elsperman. We'll catch up on all that she's been doing, trade missions to China, etc., and also find out a little bit more about the woman who holds the second highest ranking office in Indiana state government. We'll find out what brought her to politics in the first place and what she's learned from her years in office. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. And you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Lieutenant Governor Sue Elsperman. Welcome to the program. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
And if our audience would like to join the conversation, you can do so by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, you've managed to stay busy here in the past few months. There are a lot of things we can talk about, and as I said off the air as well, I want to talk a little bit, since the first time you've been on the show and first chance really our audience has to get to know you, I want to talk about your personal story a little bit. We can do that later. Let's focus on, you just came back, a little bit more than 2 months ago from a trade mission to China. Could you talk a little bit about that trip, what the goals were, and what came from it?
Well, as Lieutenant Governor, I serve as Secretary of Agriculture and Rural Development, and so the two trade missions we've made, both to Asia, have been really focused on agriculture and those opportunities to grow the agricultural economy. So this year, we went to China, which, as you can guess, 1.3 billion people. It's a big market for the U.S., and certainly Indiana has lots to export, from soybeans to corn to specialty crops to pork, particularly swine genetics, areas that really make a great difference in agriculture. So we took a trade mission of 20 delegates to China, visited several of the provinces, particularly though this time we focused on Sichuan, which is an agricultural part of China, not one of those frequently traveled places. And really saw great opportunities working with their, we have Purdue University, one of the top five or six worldwide agricultural universities, but working with their universities and also working with their farmers and their industry to look for how does Indiana make a difference in China. While we were there, we also went to the Beijing International Food Show, showcasing some of the products that come out of Indiana. And then visited, we have a sister state relationship with Zhejiang in China, so we did that. And then finally, one of our new industries that have come to Indiana is Haier, H-A-I-E-R, twice the size of Whirlpool, beginning a tech center in Evansville. And this also became a first opportunity for someone from the state to visit Haier. We see great opportunities to grow that industry in southern Indiana, and so had the opportunity to do that too while I was there. So very, very good opportunities. Saw from the Chinese people and their leaders the kind of challenges they're facing as they expand their middle class, and also then how do we support that growth. Pork and proteins, particularly, I'd say protein in the diet is what you see most when you see an expanding country. And so Indiana's got some great opportunities, and we exploited many of them and had some great success.
This was your second trip right, to Asia. Yes. The second trade mission, was it were these the first two times you'd been in that part of the world? Had you been there in your private
been,
life before?
Had been in some of my business work privately, had been to Thailand prior to that. But we were in Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan last summer. And a great way to be introduced to Asia and the opportunities that exist there.
Well, and obviously, Governor Pence just came back from a trip to Japan. Can you talk a little bit about why that part of the world is as important as it is to Indiana's economic health and development?
Well, we've had a long-term relationship with Japan and Indiana, going back many administrations. And, of course, Indiana has more manufacturing presence of Japanese companies than any other state in the nation. So we're very proud of that Japan relationship and see it as such a good thing for Hoosiers, good thing for Japan with their presence here. So that, with those relationships, you continue to nurture them, and you see over now many decades how that's made a difference in the state. Likewise, with China or any of those other Asian countries, those relationships matter, just as they would here in the United States. You need to build the relationships, and more so in China than other parts of Asia, it's important that government-to-government introductions happen in order to open doors, and then the business-to-business work can be accelerated. And so China was very important in that respect, that I go or Governor go, and in fact, we both have gone to China this year. But with the magnitude of that market, the opportunities that exist, it was imperative that we go.
Are there still friction points in relationship between Indiana and China? I know every governor I've talked to since Robert Orr, you know, 30 years ago would talk about how there was a cultural barrier you had to negotiate first before you could get down to the business pieces of it.
Well, certainly there are culturally, if you want to say that, or governmentally, I would say operationalized, it's just a little different in how you do business in China. You do need the government to give the nod as business-to-business relationships happen. I would say it's less so. Of course, what do I have to compare it to? I wasn't there years ago, but I suspect it's less so. China has come along to look a lot like America. For instance, we had the opportunity to visit Alibaba while we were in China. They happened to be in our sister province. You know, you would think you were an American company. And certainly the entrepreneurial spirit is alive there. But that's not all of China. It's it's just changing. And so, you know, you would say that that's probably going to become, over the long run, less and less. There's still significant trade issues, and in agriculture particularly. And, of course, when you're a state, you can't negotiate the trade deal that you want. But we call it soft diplomacy, being there, bringing farmers with us, bringing agricultural leaders with us. We could have the kind of conversations that are important for their government leaders, their university leaders, their business leaders to have to understand that agriculture is safe in America, that we use best practices, that certainly we export our best products to them. You know, we could overcome some misperceptions that they hear.
And I do want to talk about other policy points, but I think this is appropriate to ask. You are, you know, you grew up in a small town, right?
I did.
And here in Indiana, when you're doing things like this, when you're leading trade missions to other countries, major powers like Japan and China, do you ever kind of walk around and think, oh, how did I get here? You know, what brought me to this point in life? What is it like to be doing that and thinking, okay.
Well, I'd say more it's the responsibility of making sure it's done well, that you're very respectful of why you're there, who you're representing. You represent all Hoosiers, but more importantly, you represent all Americans while you're there, and that you come well prepared, and that you listen as well as share. And I think I'm very cognizant. I think growing up in a small town, maybe even more so, relationships really matter, that we're there not just to bring a deal home. Yes, we want that at the end of the day, but we're there to make sure that we represent the people that we are, that we build those relationships, we build the trust, so that over the long run, good things will happen, both in Indiana and across the country.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Indiana Lieutenant Governor Sue Elsperman. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Lee has done and send us an email. And you can do that at nolimits@wfyi.org. Lee asks, what's the most unexpected but important lesson you've learned since becoming Lieutenant Governor? Lee, you anticipated one of my questions from later on, but I won't hold it against you.
There have been so many lessons learned coming into state government. You know, I think having spent, as I mentioned to you, I've spent really the majority of my life in the private sector, owned my own business for 20 years, did transition working in a university for 6 years. So I think that maybe has been my springboard back into, but having been with large corporations prior to that, you know, state government doesn't run as fast as I'd like to see it run. You know, you don't make change as quickly as you'd like things to happen. But coming in, you understand that we are responsible to every Hoosier, every taxpayer. Transparency is critical. How decisions are made, the way we go about doing business has to be so carefully done to ensure that all the I's are dotted, T's are crossed. When I ran my own company, I could make a decision and tomorrow move in that direction. In state government, whether you're in the legislature crafting the statute or whether you're in the administration executing the budget, executing that statute, it just needs to be very deliberately done, done correctly, done above all reproach, so that Hoosiers can be proud of their state government and know, we know, that every dollar has been spent fairly and appropriately.
What, and I'm going to jump ahead here a little bit, and I promise we will get back to the work you're doing with the Bicentennial and so many other things, but since Lee kind of opened the door here, what has been the hardest part of making that transition from private life to public life? I mean, as you say, you spent the bulk of your life so far as a private citizen, and you know, part of what happens when you take an oath of office is, in effect, you do become public property for that period of your life.
Well, and I'd say that really is it. So, you know, having lived my life, been a business owner, a mother, you know, doing all the things everyone does in private life, having decided to run for office really just over 6 years ago, once elected, you realize everything you do is really in the public domain. Very different feeling to be known as a politician, which still doesn't feel right to me to be called. But knowing that people think of you in that way and you really are on 24/7 and it is a different way. And from your private life, mm-hmm. you know, my husband lives 3 hours south of here in our hometown of Ferdinand. Mm-hmm. You know, getting to see grandchildren, which I now have three, not nearly as often as I'd like to, mm-hmm. but it is a different pace. And for the Hoosiers you serve, you understand that you serve them all the time. And so finding that time to be off is important to catch who you are again, because you cannot be in the public's eye all the time. I think you can try, but to do your best, you really do need to catch that breath periodically.
What prompted you? You said you made the first decision 6 years ago. What prompted you to decide, okay?
You know, John, I never intended to do that. You know, I was going to be an engineer. I decided that at the end of high school, pursued that. Then really after a long career of doing, my background's industrial engineer, but then problem solving and strategic planning led me to do a lot of community-based collaborations. So I was very involved and then had the opportunity to start the Center for Applied Research at the University of Southern Indiana, more community work, problem solving collaboration, leading to projects I was doing here at the state for Lieutenant Governor Skillman at the time. And then seeing, as I was involved in crafting Indiana's rural strategic plan, that there was a lot of work to be done in rural Indiana. And I made the mistake or the right thing of asking, you know, we need to do some things. We need to do some things differently. And the person next to me said, you need to go through the Luger series. And that's a program for women to become engaged in the Republican Party in good public service. So Richard Luger, what a great role model. So when I went through that training, I did it to figure out how to become more engaged, never thinking about running for anything, but got asked at the end of that period of time, and then really did some soul searching and thinking, if I don't do it, if I'm not willing to step forward, then who should be? And so I did.
We will continue talking with Lieutenant Governor Sue Ellspermann about her journey to the office she holds now and much of the work she is doing. You are listening to No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with Lieutenant Governor Sue Ellspermann. And just before the break, we were talking about the decision to sort of leave private life and enter into public life. I think we owe Dick Luger for that. It sounds like one of the Luger symbols. After you got elected, to the House of Representatives, Indiana House of Representatives, in 2010. You really hadn't been there all that long when Mike Pence said, would you like to leave the legislative branch and join me in running for lieutenant governor? What was your response when he made the request?
Well, I tell the true story. I got a phone call on, I think it was a Friday afternoon, from someone on his staff saying, would I like to be vetted for the lieutenant governor? And I was very cool and calm on the call and said, well, let me talk to my husband. Let me pray about it. And can I get back to you on Monday? And he said, sure. I went right back home and Googled the individual's name to make sure he was associated with the Mike Pence campaign, because I thought, oh, my goodness, who would ask a 2-year legislator to be lieutenant governor? So I was pretty sure that that name would come and go, and they would find someone much better. Truthfully, I have a very strong relationship with the Sisters of St. Benedict in my hometown, 150 women religious, and I called the retired prioress, and I said, would you just pray about this with me, and just pray that he picks the best person? And I was pretty sure that as I went through the vetting, I would give plenty of answers that would suggest that there was someone better out there. And so when he called a few weeks later and asked if I would be the lieutenant governor, I really believe that this was an opportunity. God was asking me to step forward. And I think I mean that in a general sense for all, whether you see it as a faith-based decision or not, that we're all called to public service at some time. And when that door opens, we need to be prepared to say yes. And so I'm very privileged to be here. It's been quite a nearly 3 years now journey, and one that we really do, and I make this part of my challenge now to encourage particularly women, but all those who serve important roles out in everyday world, whether you're a teacher or a nurse or a doctor or a farmer. We really do need our best and brightest to step forward to be engaged in public service and be prepared to take some time out of your career to do that role, because that really is how our government was designed. And if we want good government, we really need to encourage our best people to step forward.
Do you feel a special burden, you know, because you are a woman and women have been historically underrepresented in not just state government, but every branch of at every level of government? We did a show actually a couple of years ago with Lieutenant Governor, your predecessor, Lieutenant Governor Becky Skillman, and State Senator Beverly Gard, and Maggie Lewis with the, and they talked about, you know, this extra layer of responsibility when you are. In effect, a standard bearer, a torch bearer, someone who is serving as a kind of pioneer. Do you feel that kind of pressure too, or pressure might not be the right word?
Yeah.
Responsibility. would be a better one.
You know,
perhaps.
My entire career, I've always been or often been the only woman in the room. As an engineer,
usually
first one at the table, the only woman at the table. Yeah. In manufacturing, one of the few, if not the only woman supervisor around. As a woman business owner, one of the fewer. So I don't feel a burden about it, but I do feel like in every one of those settings, I feel the call to call other women forward, to encourage them. Because I remind women, we are not a minority. We are the majority. I kiddingly say we could rule the world if we just really got organized. So it really is up to each of us to encourage and mentor. And I'm feel very strongly about that, whether we're talking engineering or politics or STEM. We really do need that's part of the job, and it's part of the opportunity of being here is to have that opportunity. I was in Washington, D.C. on Monday of this week at Million Women Mentors, which is a program to encourage young women in STEM. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every opportunity we can, then for the next generation, I'm the mother of two daughters and two stepdaughters. Mm-hmm. My daughters, and the youngest is finishing her Ph.D. in biomedical engineering. She doesn't feel that at all anymore. Her field is actually 50-50. That's a great accomplishment. So we need to keep that going. We're not there yet. Women, 25% of STEM jobs only are filled by women. We need to get that up. But likewise, in the political arenas, Democrat or Republican, we're sitting around 20%, the state house and federal. That really needs to be 50. And so I see this as an opportunity to really encourage, to get behind women. So I will step out during primaries and get behind women in my party to encourage them and support them, because I believe that's how we will do it. We can't expect them to get there alone. Mentors are important. Supporters are important.
When we did the show with your predecessor and Senator Gard and Council President Lewis, they also talked about a kind of sisterhood that crossed partisan lines, mm-hmm. that there are times and places that you can drop the party label and just talk about common challenges. Is that still the case?
Absolutely. It sure is. And in fact, we do that usually at least once during the legislative session. We bring all of the women legislators together. My office is often filled with, from both sides of the aisle, that opportunity to work together to support one another. We will do that. It's important that that continue. And I think you see in D.C. as well, when there are good things happening, often there are women behind those actions, mm-hmm. helping to pull things together in a bipartisan way. I think women, we are collaborators. The research shows that. In legislation offered by women, there are often more co-authors involved. We can do that. We should do that. It's one of many reasons why there should be more women in elected offices, because that's part of what we bring.
And we see at the national level right now, two women running for president, which means there's a fair likelihood that we could have a female president for the first time in this country's history in about a year and a half. What is the likelihood, you think, in the near future that Indiana might see a woman governor for the first time? I almost feel like that's a harder nut to crack than the national one.
You know, I guess I'm very optimistic that in Indiana, as we bring good women leaders forward, Hoosiers will look at them just like we're looking nationally and saying, oh, we do have some good options there. And I think we will do that here as well. So, no, I think it will be very soon. I'm optimistic about it, and we'll certainly continue to encourage good women to step forward in this state.
Well, and you know that the natural question after I've asked the previous one is that something you would have any interest in doing down the line?
I always say is number two, you're always prepared to be number one. So I spend every day trying to make sure I understand all of state government, be prepared to step in. I did have 6 hours over the last summer when Governor Pence was under the knife and
under anesthesia.
I said I'm now putting that on my resume as having a two-term governor twice. But it is one that I will prepare for. And then really, just as I discerned being lieutenant governor, I will do the same thing if or when that day comes to look at governor. It's important to me not to run for governor just to be the first woman, but it would have to be that I believe that I'm the right candidate to run to serve Hoosiers, 6.5 million Hoosiers, and making sure that that's right for them. So certainly it's a possibility.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Indiana Lieutenant Governor Sue Elsperman. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, when you came to the position of Lieutenant Governor, what goals did you have for the office? I mean, what things, you know, most people I know who are successful have this list of 4 or 5 big things they want to get done. What was your list for the office?
Well, I'll tell you why I said yes. The beyond it being, you know, Congressman Pence asking, is that growing up in a small town of 2200 Ferdinand in rural Du Bois County and having traveled the state and seeing the challenges rural Indiana was facing, I really feel this is the time if we're going to not only save but grow rural Indiana, we have to make sure that we're doing things ranging from rural broadband to the economic development tools that rural communities have to education in small communities. My husband is a junior, senior high school principal of one of those small high schools schools in southern Indiana. I have to make sure that education can thrive. So my passion is really making sure that all of Indiana thrives. We know our cities are doing well, but making sure those rural communities are doing well and are, again, attracting talent back. So for generations now, we have been exporting our best and brightest. I'm one of 6. 5 no longer live in our hometown. I'm the only one who came back, and that was in my mid-40s. So we have some work to do to make sure that those communities can, they are the place where so many good things happen, where great families are being raised, where much of the talent that we see in this great city of Indianapolis comes from those small communities. They're important, and yet often it's easy to overlook what's happening there and their own unique challenges. In fact, in a lot of ways, some of our rural communities look more like urban inner city than suburbia. And we have to make sure that our policies and tools and how we partner with is truly supporting the development of those communities. And as Lieutenant Governor, I oversee both agriculture and the Office of Community and Rural Development. So OCRA is important in there in helping us make sure that we're serving our smaller communities.
What's the toughest nut to crack for those rural communities? Because you're right, they are often overlooked in part because they're small. And let's face it, on the other side, there's also in those rural small communities a certain resistance to change, too. So you've got pressures resisting it at both ends of the dynamic.
I think the greatest challenge has to do with quality of place, which attracts talent, right? So it's you have to have the kind of communities that young people will want to move back to. Yes, the schools are typically good, so the good schools is good, but they need more. And you're often now 2 career couples. So those dual careers, you might find a career for one, but where's the other one going to work? So when we made the decision, my husband and I were a blended family now, and we had made the decision almost 15 years ago now, but to live back in Ferdinand, our hometown. But I, to work as a PhD, was working in Evansville, the west side of Evansville, over an hour drive each way. Mm-hmm. That's not a high quality of life. So we have to make sure that we have good job opportunities. We're attracting those good companies into those rural communities. They don't have to be large headquarters, but contract engineering firms and, you know, the suppliers for the medical device industry, the high-tech, high-wage kinds of, even if they're boutique-sized businesses, that they provide those range of opportunities for those dual career wage earners and families to both have very fruitful careers and good quality of life at the same time.
You get to do in this job some kind of cool things. I mean, you're obviously intimately involved in planning for the state's bicentennial. I mean, that's the kind of celebration that by definition comes along once every 200 years. So what are the best parts of the job? And then could we talk a little bit also about, you know, the bicentennial and what Hoosiers can expect?
Sure. Well, very excited to celebrate our 200th anniversary as a state. One of the agencies I oversee is the Office of Tourism Development. So a piece of that celebration, particularly one piece called the Torch Relay, is something that we will be promoting. And that Torch Relay is taken off the Olympic theme, the Olympic Torch. Mm-hmm. It will travel all 92 counties starting next fall. Over 2,000 miles. It will be carried in lots of different ways and, you know, from running to walking to boats and anything you can imagine. But it will be a great way to celebrate our state. So we're very excited about that. We are, I'm going to mention, still looking for torch bearers. So if you want to nominate somebody to carry that torch through your county, we can still take those nominations. That's a great thing, but the bicentennial in general will be hundreds of projects completed over this next year. The Bicentennial Commission, which is being led by Lieutenant Governor Becky Skillman mm-hmm. and Congressman Lee Hamilton, doing a fabulous job with the commission. And my favorite personal project is the one that Lee approached me on, which was to lead the bicentennial visioning, which his comment was, shame on us if we celebrate 200 years, but we don't think ahead to the next 50 to 100 years as a state, and what do we want to be? So since my background is strategic planning and visioning, I stepped forward and said, I'd be happy to do that with you. So he is our honorary chair, and we have just now begun 12 sessions across the state pulling together our thought leaders in areas from economy to agriculture to education to civic engagement, environment, 12 sessions where we're asking those thought leaders, people who've been nominated by others, to give what they think we could be the next 25, 50 years out. And we're going to be publishing, I won't call it a book per se, a report, an instrument that will help educate public servants, civic leaders, community leaders, business leaders on what are the big ideas that Indiana might pursue over the next 25 or 50 years. And that is the nice thing is it gets beyond the partisan. We go out far enough out that it's not the next election or even the next election after that. But where does Indiana really want to go and what would it take? What are the big ideas that could move us in those directions? So after two sessions, I can tell you that they're exciting. We're hearing great ideas from great leaders. The names, we'll publish the long list of names mm-hmm. of all those who have participated. But it's a great opportunity for us to seed mm-hmm. future leaders on directions that we might want to go as a state and look for good people on both sides of the aisle to pick up on the ideas and community leaders, civic leaders, take them forward.
What's one of the big ideas that's emerged so far? Can you give us a taste?
I cannot tell you yet. No, And in fact, in the sessions, we probably will surface, both the sessions, we've surfaced between 75 and 100 ideas, of which we cull down to a handful out mm-hmm. of each session. And then Norm Hyken, who you may know, is our editor. He will then flesh out even further what that really means. So at the end, you'll have a really polished set of 50 to 100 really big ideas coming out of it. It's an exciting opportunity as a state, one that I consider it a legacy project. I think probably Norm does as well. It's a real, it's truly a pleasure to be able to bring these best minds, greatest Hoosiers together to share their thoughts.
We are talking with Indiana Lieutenant Governor Sue Elsperman here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Indiana Lieutenant Governor Sue Elsperman. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Mary Beth has done and reach out to us via Twitter. And you can find us there at WFYI. Mary Beth says, do you support adding LGBT to Indiana civil rights laws? And would you vote for it if there is a tie in the Senate? Clearly, we got a government junkie here, someone who knows the process.
Yeah, this last spring was a challenging time because as that religious freedom bill came forward, we really didn't anticipate the concerns that would be raised by the LGBT community, and certainly no discrimination was intended. And so the fix this spring was important that was done, and I think what we've heard is Hoosiers are probably not satisfied yet. They want to be assured 100% that is there is no further discrimination. So, you know, my opinion is that we should get that fixed, that whatever that looks like, what that next step needs to be. And I know there are, you know, the General Assembly said last spring we would look at it. They are. You always are careful to say what will you vote for, because you have to see it before you can say, will I vote for that or not? But I think we've heard, I know the governor's heard, we've heard the concerns that Hoosiers have had on that issue. And I think it just has reaffirmed that Hoosiers do not tolerate discrimination. They do want to protect religious freedom. Absolutely. We are very faith-based people. But they also do not in any way want to discriminate. So I think this fall, this next session, I fully expect that will be on the table, and we'll continue to work through it. So I think, you know, I certainly can say this, that I certainly don't support any level of discrimination, and like most Hoosiers, have so many friends and people that we work with, that we go to church with, that are LGBT and just the best people we could ever ask for, great citizens, great Hoosiers, great colleagues, great family members, great friends. So, you know, we're going to do what we need to do to make things right.
What was it like, you know, to be, if not at the center, very close to the center of that storm while it was going on? You mentioned the fact that that the reaction caught people off guard, and you know, I think it's safe to say, I hope I'm not putting words in anyone's mouth, that this was not the way Indiana wanted to make international news or become a focus of national and international attention. It had to have been a difficult time. Could you talk a little bit about what it was like to be?
Sure. You know, I thought, having been the vice chair of labor during Right to Work, that I had lived through some challenging times with 2000 labor leaders and members in the General Assembly in our State House. But this was different because this is very much an emotional topic, and it was very hard to hear Hoosiers or others, because many of these came nationwide and worldwide accusations on what the intentions of that bill were. And I know I can only speak to the intentions of the people I know personally involved, but it was very hard to have to, you know, I had to not look at social media directly because the comments were, as you know, people will say things in an email that they would probably not necessarily say to your face. So it was very difficult. And I know for, I'm sure I can speak for Governor on that too, that those are tough things. And really what you realize as an elected official, we come into this, you know that you have to have thick skin and to always try to be the adult in the room and to try to make things right and to try to assure Hoosiers where we are, what, you know, what was not intended, and try to be as honest as you can. And then I think our job is to listen. It is to be able to hear and continue to consider, given what you're hearing, and make adjustments accordingly.
As you've alluded to, there have been some bruising battles in Indiana in the past few years, starting with right to work, and then we had the whole same-sex constitutional amendment fight, and then RFRA. And I'm not interested in talking about who's right or who's wrong. This is a different kind of forum. I have heard from people within state government that that fractured a lot of relationships along the way. Has that been your perception, that there's a greater level of distrust or animosity along partisan lines, in part because these fights did get to be so bitter?
It's hard for me to say because I came in 2011. Maybe I'm the cause of all that. I haven't decided yet of all the controversy. But I came in 2011, so I don't know what it was like before that. I will say, for me, relationships have always been important on both sides of the aisle. And I can honestly say that there are, 100 legislators in the House and 50 in the Senate that I'm proud to work with. And I think most of us, if you're there for the right reasons as a legislator or as in our administration, you must be willing to work together. We can never use anything like that as an excuse to why we can't or why we won't. I refuse for us to look like D.C. has at times. You know, we have to be, we are a small state. We are people. Most of what we want is a lot the same. We have different ideas on how to get there. And our job is to bring all those stakeholders around the table and figure things out. And that's my background in problem solving, says different points of view are good. And that when we bring those different points of view around a table, we get better solutions. And that consensus is always better than not having consensus because it will move forward better. The implementation is better. So trying to get there, not on all issues, I realize we will not always get to consensus, but we should always strive for consensus. And knowing that even when we can't get there, we've heard all points of view.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Indiana Lieutenant Governor Sue Elsperman. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Martha, who sent us an email, did, and reach out to us via email at nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, first, very good to hear your voice on the radio. Presumably that's yours, not mine. I've heard excellent things about you, and they are confirmed by your interview. I live in rural Indiana and manage family farms, but I also translate Chinese economic policy for a think tank in China's State Council. The report I am currently working on is all about China's agriculture. It covers things like food security, safety, the 1/6 of China's farmland that is polluted with heavy metals, and so on. This has major implications for us. How can I get the strategic considerations into the bloodstream of Indiana's government leaders?
Wow, that's quite a question and quite an accomplishment for Martha. So, Martha, I think getting that, and if we can find a way to respond to your email, I'm sure I can get that email address and we'll make some direct comments back. But our Indiana State Department of Agriculture, led by Director Ted McKinney, really does a great job at within the state representing farmers. We're the advocates for agriculture and agribusiness. We have many of our companies, be they Dow AgriScience, Elanco, have big operations in China as well, and have products that serve the world. So we want to always be in the right spot. We work with our congressional delegation in policy that goes into farm bills, et cetera. But again, it is ultimately a federal decision in terms of the trade deals that are made with foreign nations. But I think I will share with Martha, one of the things I found most intriguing, the Ministry of Agriculture deputy that I was meeting with in China, in Beijing, asked how their concerns are that agriculture is very difficult over there because so many of the young people have moved into the cities. The average age of a farmer is more than 10 years older than here in the U.S. And so did we have ways we could help? And so we recommended some of our leadership programs. You know, in the United States, we have two. We have 4-H and we have FFA. FFA reports through the State House through my agency of ISDA, and we're also home for national FFA. I really think, and we are bubbling this idea of really encouraging, stewarding China to consider partnering with us in developing a Chinese version of FFA. And that would mean stewarding them through the development. But what that would help do is bring best practices of agriculture to a nation that really needs it. And it would help bridge some of the concerns and the practices that would help make the world a lot smaller in agriculture. So I think we discovered that there are more ways to work together than just as you think about business to business. There is university to university, and then there are programs like FFA and 4-H to across nations that could be woven together. So I think there's much to do, and the strategic considerations are this is a long-term relationship. We've got to get it right now, and we need to think towards the future to building a generation that will. Food safety is important, and that good information on agriculture is out there, and that we're training the next generation in the best ways, and that we have our universities and the research being shared appropriately so that we can feed 9 billion people by 2050.
Mm-hmm. You'd mentioned earlier when we first were talking about China that one of the benefits of these trade missions is that it gives you a chance to correct some misperceptions about Indiana, about the United States. What is the biggest or the hardest misperception to correct that's out there about Indiana or even the United States?
Yeah,
done this a couple of times.
I don't think that there's a misconception about Indiana specifically. That in China, there are some misconceptions that somehow we're not sending them our best product. And so one of those being, I kind of jokingly on this one, so one of them complained about cracked corn. And really that had more to do with it being the end of the season, the bottom of grain storage bins. And so you have a little more cracking than you have in the rest of the year. So sometimes it's explaining what is happening and the areas of GMOs, genetically modified. I think that's a correction that needs to be made not only in China, but in Europe and in the U.S. as well, as understanding the food safety elements of how our food is grown and that genetically modified doesn't, there's no science behind it not being healthy. And without it, we couldn't feed the world as it is today. So we have to, but we saw the same kind of concerns percolating in China, as we've heard in Europe, and a little less so in the U.S. But there, you know, it's a small world today. So what travels here and social media makes it around the world as well.
We have a question from a caller who didn't want to go on the air and says, is the lieutenant governor doing anything to combat voter apathy? As you know, Indiana did not fare well in voter turnout. We were dead last among the states. What are you doing? What can be done to combat that problem?
Yeah. You know, and I shared a little bit of this earlier. I think the best thing we can do is make sure we have great candidates running again, both sides of the aisle, encouraging great people to step forward. When you do, I think you encourage people to get involved. Not everyone's going to run, but you're more likely to get involved if you see good people in their running that you'd like to be associated with and you think are making a change or can make a change. And so my encouragement always, and I start with the fourth graders in my office when they come through for their tours in Indiana history, all the way up through high school seniors coming through, to talk about, put on your to-do list at some time in your lifetime, in your career, public service, whether it's school board or whether it is being a mayor or county commissioner or state rep or congressional or president. That is part of being an American. And I think when we start taking more responsibility to be involved with government, then we will see that absolutely voting is a part of it. It is making sure this level of engagement is at all level. I don't know how to say that. At really from the elected level to the supporting people who are running for offices all the way to the voting and paying attention to who's running and what they stand for. But I think the best I can do is really encourage good people to step forward.
Got a Facebook question from a listener named Deb who says that she and her husband own a winery and are seeing some great success due to renewed interest in agribusiness, thanks for Indiana Grown. We are trying to expand but are struggling to find banks that get the agritourism model. Likewise, traditional ag funding avenues do not know what to do with us. Does the state have any program to support development of agritourism resources, loans or grants?
Well, I will direct her to another agency I have, which is called the Office of Small Business and Entrepreneurship. Indiana is home to 10 regional small business development centers, which that is their job, to help you develop the business plan, help connect you with funding, help develop marketing plans, get you connected to the resources you need. So I would certainly encourage her to reach out to her local Indiana Small Business Development Center or look us up at Office of Small Business and Entrepreneurship on our state website, and we can get her to some resources, because that is part of the interconnection of building capacity in those communities, is making sure that not only the ISDA's role is primarily around helping encourage wineries and specialty crops and locally grown, all that's in their wheelhouse, but our small business and entrepreneurship is really about helping the business model succeed and hooking them up, getting them with the resources they need, and I would highly recommend that.
Well, as usual, some of the best questions seem to be flooding in right as we're ready to go off the air. That will have to be. But I hope you will take that as an invitation to come back sometime. We've enjoyed having you here and enjoyed talking with you.
I would love to do that, John. Thank you very much.
Certainly. You have been listening to No Limits. I am John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.